the balmy weather we're having. I'm having a real rough time, I can tell you that. So anyway, I am here actually to talk about a new initiative, fairly new, although it's been in the works for some time, that a number of federal agencies have put together. And the strategy itself is called, the title is Advancing Healthy Housing, a Federal Strategy for Action. And the first thing I want to do is acknowledge some very important people. So my HUD colleagues and Peter Ashley, you're going to hear from him shortly, also my boss, so everybody like clap really loudly at the end for me. Warren Friedman, who's a senior advisor in our office, and then Matt Ammon, our office deputy director. And I should mention, Betsy had asked me to do this, and I completely forgot. I mentioned I do work in the Office of Healthy Homes and Lead Hazard Control at HUD. I'm a health scientist in the Policy and Standards Division, and we take on a number of different projects that relate to healthy homes and look more from a research perspective and how we can use research to inform different policies. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from here and looking to move things into the practice. So that's a little bit of a very brief statement on what our office does, and Pete will talk more about that. I am also here representing most definitely the Federal Healthy Homes Work Group, which is an interagency of represented from 9 different agencies. We have Department of Agriculture, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Department of Energy, the U.S. EPA. Particularly, we work with a number of different offices, but at EPA, but specifically here today is the Indoor Environments Division, and then also we work with the Office of Children's Health Protection quite frequently. Health and Human Services, Department of Labor, the National Institute of Environmental Sciences, and then the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And I will mention that our strategy was developed and completed under the auspices of the President's Task Force on Environmental Health, Risk and Safety Risk to Children, which is sort of a steering committee group of all agencies, and our work here definitely relates to children, so they took on the umbrella component, and we worked under their guidance. Very much appreciated. So this is my really complex slide, and I just wanted to get people to think, have you ever seen this indicator light before? I'm sure everybody has. How about that one? And then the dreaded check engine light. You know, everybody hates this one because you think your car is getting ready to explode. But really, you could be looking at any number. There are 25 indicator lights there, and I just pulled this from the search engine. But the point is, when you get indicator lights on your car, it makes you do something. It's telling you you've got a problem, and it's basically saying, Houston, we've got a problem. You need to pull over, get to a garage, go home and look and see what is causing your sensor to go off for some reason. And that's kind of nice to have that, because it's a proactive system that allows you to sort of stop and take stock of the issues that your car is having. Now think about your house, whatever kind of house you live in, either an apartment or a row house. I have a floating house there, an adobe house, bungalow, whatever. How many indicator lights do you have in your house that tell you, by the way, you know, when we had that horizontal rain for 3 days the other week and you hadn't caulked around your windows, well, guess what? You've got water infiltration into the wall of your house, and it was 85% humidity. Maybe there's a mold issue. Do we have sensors for this? The answer is, it's rhetorical, no, we don't. You may have a smoke detector. Hopefully. You may have a carbon monoxide detector if you have a gas furnace. Aside from that, maybe if you have a security system, I have one on my house in North Carolina. If you have a security system, then you may have some other benefits to that. But really, we don't have sensors. We don't have a sensor that says, your bathroom fan doesn't exhaust adequately, and so you're getting moisture in your bathroom, you've got mold. You don't have a sensor that says you've got too much NO2 coming off of your gas stove. You don't have one for particulates. So basically we have more sensors and more information being provided by our car than we do for our home. And when you look at where we spend our time, that's a little surprising. And I realize there are a number of different issues. You know, we don't drive our house out onto the interstate unless you happen to own an RV. But really, what I look at this and I see, well, we have. I'm an industrial hygienist by background, so I like to look at things from an exposure perspective. And when you're spending 70% of your time in one microenvironment, that's a lot of contact time to any potential issues that may be in that home. So your exposure risks go up dramatically. And so the next thing to think about, though, is do our homes really have issues that we should be concerned with? You know, we have the time spent in that microenvironment, but do we really have to be concerned? And the answer, again, the question was rhetorical. The answer is yes, we do. Because all these bars here, the columns, are in millions. And what I'm showing here, it may be a little small to see, like the smallest bar, 1.1, number of low-income households that have lead hazards and a child under 6, which is the population, the demographic that's most at risk, for 6 million. There's 6 million housing units in the U.S. with moderate to severe physical infrastructure problems. And this is from the 2009 American Housing Survey. 17 million have high exposure burden to indoor allergens. And that's significant. And then we have 23 that have more lead-based paint hazards in their home. And then the pink one on the end I just threw in for perspective, just to give you an idea, what is 23 million, how do you compare that? Well, if you took the total number of housing units in the state of California and also in the state of New York and combined, that total would be 21 million. So basically we're saying we have two full states of lead-based paint hazards, housing units with lead-based paint hazards, and that's pretty significant. But do these problems really have burdens associated that we need to be concerned with? And again, the answer is yes. And I have to give a shout out here to Lead Saves Illinois at Loyola University in Chicago, because I found this graphic on the web and I thought it was fantastic. I've modified it slightly, but it just very succinctly gives you what the potential exposures are. And on the left, you'll see like lead, pests, mold, air quality, water quality, and then other. And then the health burden, there are quite a few listed. And this really doesn't even get to all the potential hazards you might face. But it does give you an idea of, just with the ones that are mentioned, the health burden. So with lead, you know, we have cognitive impairment. We have social behavioral issues. And then if you get into the pests and the mold, we have, you know, clearly asthma and allergies. And in some cases with, like, pesticides, some neurological issues. And then with air quality, if you look at radon, you know, 21,000 new lung cancer deaths every year associated with residential radon exposure. And then I added unintentional injuries, because this is an issue that my office takes quite a bit of interest in, because it does have significant impacts. And the last graphic on the right is the economic burden, and there's direct and indirect costs, and these are significant. So if you look, and this is just, you know, a sample of, and based on some of the information we have, and we, if there are any academics in the room, we actually could use a little more research in this area. We'd love to get a better handle on things for a larger group of risk factors, but unintentional injuries is huge. $200 billion a year in direct and indirect costs. That's considerable. We might be able to solve some of the budget issues in this country if we start looking at how we can reduce these costs. Lead poisoning, $50 billion in economic lost economic productivity, also significant. When you look at that's a chronic issue. That's something that's going to be difficult to change long term with individuals that have cognitive impairment. So the best thing to do is to prevent that. Childhood asthma, $7 billion. Asthma from dampness and mold, $3.5 billion annually. So these are big numbers that sort of are driving the decision to do something at the federal level. So just as a quick summary, there's a legitimate need for action, which is why we took this on. Health and safety issues are everywhere, and they're just plentiful is the word I use, and I think that's sufficient. Time spent is a critical factor, that contact time that I was talking about. Exposure is a function of concentration and time, or the amount of the risk factor and time. And so that time component is something probably won't be changing that, so we need to look at the other pieces we can change. Adverse health outcomes, we have documented scientific research that shows there's that link. And then, unfortunately, as it always seems to be, the most susceptible and vulnerable populations are the ones that are most impacted. And so especially at HUD, we take great care in making sure we're looking at those populations and what we do. So what did we do? So the Healthy Homes Work Group was established in 2009, and they decided to put this strategy for action together. And I'm just now talking about it in 2013, if that gives you any sense of the process and how cumbersome it was. And I've only been with HUD since 2011, so it had started well before I got involved. And when I read through at the beginning the list of agencies, and some might be surprised, Department of Energy, why would they be interested in healthy housing? Well, they come from the weatherization perspective. And what is weatherization doing to the home that might be impacting health? And so we get that perspective, which is awesome. USDA deals with rural housing. They're looking at farms and communities like that, and so that brings a whole different element to it. And then we have the pure researchers, like at the NIEHS. And so we have this great mix of our partners, and it just makes us stronger as a result to have such expertise, collective expertise, and such great relationships. And I will say that has been one of the best things. There's just tremendous synergy among these agencies, and it has made us much more efficient and much more effective. And you don't hear that a lot when people talk about the government, so I do have to give a shout out to how this has worked at the federal level. It's really quite impressive. Other efforts that are similar that have the Asthma Disparities Strategic Plan, and I know that's not the correct word and the full title of it, but that's basically that plan came out shortly before ours did, and that one is another example of doing great things collaboratively because it's many of the same players. And the Federal Radon Action Plan, which has been spearheaded by the EPA's Indoor Environments Division, is another awesome example of how working together can then create such great products. And that one is very successful. I've been working on that, and it's doing some really exciting things right now. And so from all of this, the Advancing Healthy Housing Strategy for Action was born. Whoop, I'm hitting the wrong button again. So this is the cover of our strategy, and we launched on February 4th, 2013, and this was a big affair. Not in terms of, it wasn't a party. I'm being recorded, so I have to say there were no dancers or anything at this event. But we didn't give away iPads or anything. But it was attended, and our speakers were high level. You know, the Secretary of HUD, this is the head of our agency who was appointed by the President to lead HUD. So we had the EPA administrator at the time. She's now since moved to private life and probably some normalcy. The Surgeon General. So these are all high-level people, and they took this on, and it's hard to get them at these events. So for them to all come together shows there's a lot of support at the highest level for this effort. And the strategy itself is it's sort of laid out to look at over a 3 to 5 year span. And then at that point, you know, we're going to be revisiting every year, but initially we were looking at that time frame to sort of get some things going. And you should know that the Advancing Healthy Housing is revolving around this concept of the Healthy Homes model, and I'm going to talk next briefly about that. So this is a conceptual model that looks to be very comprehensive, and the word that's used a lot when we talk about it is holistic, looking at it as a systems-based model as opposed to just one piece at a time. And it's very proactive, or we're intending for it to be very proactive. And the intent is to, goodness gracious, is to move away from one hazard, one fix. So if you go in a home and you have a leak, well, let's go ahead and fix some other things while we're there and try and tackle as much as we possibly can. And maybe if we do we seal up a crack here or there, we may eliminate pests, moisture, and possibly radon at the same time. So, you know, let's get the good bang for our buck here. And it really is driven by this idea that prevention is key. You know, don't wait till you have major problems. Let's get in there and do something before things reach that point. And I use Niagara Falls here as kind of an amusing example. Do you want to pay upstream, or you want to pay when you're underneath the falls and you're getting, you know, the deluge of costs? So it's just perspective. And I use the word prevention because we know that these things are working. There is a return on your investment that's beneficial to everybody. And I threw up here lead hazards, $17 to over $200 for every dollar spent. Asthma, $5 to $16 for every dollar spent. And smoke alarms, about an $18 return. And again, if there are academics or other organizations in the audience, we need more of this information to really help feed, you know, our strategies and our policies. So the more information we have on this, you know, start doing some research. So within our strategy, this is actually, I don't know how many in the room have actually seen it, but this is what we have inside the strategy, just to as an icon for what our Healthy Homes model looks like, driven by a central vision with 5 goals that feed from it, and we're grounded by 8 principles or 8 characteristics of healthy housing. And some of you may be familiar with 7 principles. We decided to go crazy and add one, and I'll get to that in just 1 second. But I wanted to mention that we're not doing this in a vacuum. We are very aware of other initiatives and other ideas that are we're using to link to, and we're keeping those in mind. So just so you know, it's not being done in a vacuum. So we're looking at Healthy People 2020, and this is actually from our strategy in Appendix D, where we list the relevant objectives from Healthy People 2020. So the vision here: substantially reduce the number of American homes with health and safety hazards. So it's pretty broad and very, very direct, but it gives us a lot of room to play. And as I mentioned, we now have 8 foundational healthy home characteristics. We added thermally controlled because if you were out in last night's, you know, the cold last night, you know, if you don't have heat, this has got to be pretty bad for you. So it just, not going to get too much into these, but goals, these are the goals from the strategy, and the first two have to do with establishing what we consider our recommendations for healthy homes, and then in encouraging adoption of these. And I put a red circle around pretty much all of them except for 2.3, because the healthy homes work group, we're going after these are high priority. And in our current budget environment, we have to sort of look at our resources and see what we can do. But for goals 1 and 2, we're going after just about everything, and we're currently moving pretty quickly there. And on goals 3 and 4, I've highlighted the ones that were designated high priority. And here we're looking at the health, like replication of successful Healthy Homes model. Ruth Ann Norton is here from GHHI, the coalition, and she'll talk about that. But that's certainly one local, very successful model that we highlight in our strategy. And then educating the public about healthy homes. This the 4.1, so developing a communications campaign, that's well underway and definitely a high priority. So we're moving pretty quickly there. And this isn't to suggest the other things aren't priorities. They just were designated initially as sort of a medium or possibly, for a few exceptions, low. And then on goal 5, you know, we have data available, so we're looking to make that data very widely accessible. And the status is the implementation has been initiated, and we've prioritized, as I mentioned. We're going after the low-hanging fruit, and we will be tracking. We're going to be using performance metrics, and we'll do a green, yellow, red. We'll be posting this publicly so everyone can look for that when we go live. And just, I've kind of mentioned a few things, but just what can you do to help? We are open and encouraging people to contact us. We've had a couple industry groups talk to us who are involved with green initiatives and how can we work together to really maximize the impact here. So academics, research. We need more data, basically. Industry, like I said, we have industry partners that have already contacted us. We're looking for more. NGOs, we're doing this with Radon. Let's establish some official liaison relationships. And then on state local governments, you know, let's just keep linking up. With that, I'll stop. And if anybody has, we're taking questions at the end.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.